Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 17th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Prox, Representative Wright, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and my staff, Clark Bickford, Committee Aide to House Labor and Commerce. Today we have first bill hearings on two bills, House Bill 63 from Representative Rauscher and House Bill 57 from Representative Wright. We also have a second bill hearing on House Bill 29 from Representative McCabe. The will of the committee is to hear and hold all three bills on the agenda today. We'll start with House Bill 63 from Representative Rauscher. Will you please approach the table and start your presentation? Thank you.
My name is Representative George Rauscher, District 29. I want to take a moment to thank the chair of the committee and the committee members for hearing this bill, HB 63. HB 63, it will save $433,000 per year, remove an unnecessary bureaucracy, and make Alaska workers' compensation program move a more sustainable by repealing the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. Now, passing House Bill 63 will return jurisdiction over appeals of Workers' Compensation Board decisions to the Superior Court. Currently, the Appeals Commission handles these cases, and their decisions can be appealed to the Supreme Court. For decades, the Superior Court had handled these cases. Operating the Appeals Commission cost $433,000 annually, and it has two full-time employees, while the court system has testified that they can handle these cases with their current budget and staffing levels. The Appeals Commission workload has decreased considerably since it was created in 2005. In 2007, they have 49 new cases filed and published 42 decisions. But by 2022, they only had 14 new cases and published only 5 decisions. 2015, the House Labor and Workforce Finance Subcommittee found the Appeals Commission to be an ineffective division and that their closure rate and average time for closure is not demonstrably better than the process was before the establishment of the commission. At this time, I'd like to turn this over to my chief of staff, Ryan McKee, and he'll give you some on the on the bill itself.
One second. Let the record reflect that Representative Fields arrived at 3:17 p.m. Mr. McKee.
All right. For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher. So we've got a few slides here. We'll go through them pretty quickly. So to begin with, so House Bill 63, like Representative Rauscher said, repeals the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission and then returns this to the Superior Court with a savings of $433,000 per year. And then it helps fill the workers' compensation budget deficit and makes Alaska workers' compensation system more solvent. So just to be clear, though, we're not taking out a step for the appeals process. We're simply putting it back over to the Superior Court. So if a worker files a claim, it'll still go to the Workers' Compensation Board, and then from there, our law will then just put it back over to the Superior Court versus the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. So just want to make sure people don't think we're trying to remove a step. We're simply moving this just back over to the Superior Court where it was handled before. So currently, the commission has two full-time employees and then pays for commissioners' travel and per diem. So that's what the reduction will come from for the $433,000. We'll be removing that. And then previously, the court system has testified that they can absorb these cases with zero fiscal note. So looking back on the caseloads here, the orange line is the published decisions. The blue line is the cases filed. You'll notice there's a little bit of difference between the amount of cases filed and cases published decisions that are heard. The reason for that is for the blue line. Some of those cases, extensions were granted. Others actually solved this outside and didn't need to actually have a hearing. And others are still pending. So that's the reason that not all those cases were actually, there's published decisions for all those cases. But as you can see, the workload in 2005 to 2007, was around 40 to 50 cases. But you can see over the next few years, the caseload has dropped dramatically to 2022, where I believe there's about 6 cases were actually published. This is not the first time we have tried to do this. Back in 2015, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development Subcommittee stated that this was an ineffective division, and they suggested eliminating it. And then to add to that, Governor Walker in 2017 also moved to have this returned to the Superior Court, and it did actually pass the House 40-0. And then most recently, in 2020, Senator Wilikowski also has moved to have this eliminated. And the reason is, you know, the Superior Court took about 8 to 18 months to decide workers' compensation appeals. And the reason for creating this appeals commission in the beginning was they thought that this could get done quicker. Instead, in 2018, for example, it averaged 371 days to decide cases. And even as their workload has decreased, in 2021, they still were averaging about a little over nine months to decide these cases. And then more commission decisions are appealed to the Supreme Court, so that adds months to even years before the final decision. And when we talk about appeals, I mean, when you go to the Supreme Court, it's pretty expensive. And so when you look at these appeals, when the Superior Court handled appeals, approximately 25% of their decisions were appealed to the Supreme Court. And since the commission was created in 2005, 36% of its decisions have been appealed to the Supreme Court. And looking closer, since 2011, 50% of commission decisions have been appealed. So overall, we're seeing a growing number of these decisions that are being sent up to the Supreme Court. And that number obviously is a lot larger than what it originally started at 25%. And then with the cost to the general fund, if you see here in FY19, the tax income that's used to pay for this system just about covered the cost at $9.1 million. But over the years, you can see that that tax that's being collected has gone down. However, we still need to fund this system, and so general fund money is used to cover the difference between this. And so right now, as you can see, it's never broken even. It's always cost the state some money out of the general fund, and as the years continue to go, it continues to be a larger draw from the general fund each year. So wrapping it up, HB 63 will save about $433,000 annually, preserves parties' rights to have their cases heard in a timely manner, will reduce appeals to the Supreme Court, and make the Alaska workers' compensation system more solvent. Thank you.
So, Representative Rauscher, looks like you have some invited testimony from Eric Croft. Would you like to have us bring him on now?
To the chair, yes, we do. If you'd like to, he would like to speak.
Okay. So, Mr. Croft, you could state your name and begin your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate being here. I'll be very brief. Served in the legislature for about 10 years, and after that I did a couple of other things, but then for the last 10 years I've been representing injured workers before the board, the commission, and the Supreme Court. I'd like to compliment you for starting so punctually. That wasn't my experience way back when, so something has changed for the better in at least punctuality down there. Nice job. Just repeating some of the things that have been said from a practitioner's standpoint, the commission just doesn't have much of a workload. I don't have the exact diagram that you have in front of you, but my numbers agree. In 2022, there were only 5 cases decided by the commission. In fact, in the 3 years the last 3 years, in 20 and 21 and 22, there were 5, 11, and 9 cases decided. That's including both final decisions and what they call memorandum, which are interim orders or something less than a final decision. So in that entire time of those, both of those types, there were only 25 or about 8 a year, not even every month. Now, one could say, well, in COVID, everything slowed down. But even taking the last 13 years, going all the way back to 2010, the average for total decisions for the commission is according to my calculations, just over 12 a year, 12 and a half is the number I've got. We're about one a month. And so it's a pretty high price tag for what is not much of a workload, whether you look at it in the last 3 years or over a much longer time frame. I'd say that from our perspective, from the perspective of injured workers at the beginning, the commission, which has always been led by people that lawyers that came out of the insurance industry, insurance defense industry, had a reputation of being a very tough place for injured workers. That is almost always deciding in the insurance company's favor. I think they've done, to be fair, a somewhat of a better job and are more recently more fair. That is, the decisions go don't go as consistently one way. But in the meantime, the caseload has just continued to drop, and it's just a lot of money for not much. I do think the prior system where the court system handled it was workable. My father did this work. He and I got to work together for a long time, and that was the system that he had. And he always thought it was a better and efficient system. We have a pretty good judiciary that can do these things and learn it. So, just from a practitioner standpoint, not a workload that sustains. I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Croft. Representative Props.
I guess the first one is for the committee. How much time should we allot for this? Do we have quite a few more testifiers? Or
we have adequate time today, Representative Props.
So, thank you. Through the chair, are the commissioners effectively administrative law judges, or is it just somebody with expertise in the industry?
And Representative Prox and the committee, I'd like to recognize that Nancy Mead, general counsel for the court system, is here and probably can also answer, I would assume, could answer questions specific to the court system.
Oh, very good. I'll wait. Thank you.
She was not on the invited testimony list, but if there are specific questions, I think we could address them to her.
Yep.
What was your question?
I would just soon wait, and we'll go through the invited testimony, and then if we have questions, that's probably more.
That is our invited testimony, Representative Prox.
That was it?
Yes.
Oh. Through the chair, maybe. Ms. Mead might want to take the opportunity to answer this.
Mrs. Mead, if you could come up and.
Thank you. My name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Through the chair, Representative Prox. I am not intimately familiar with the current Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission and who is on it. So that question would not be something that I'm particularly able to answer, but I could answer other questions about this bill if it would be helpful.
Yeah. Thank you. Through the chair, I think somewhere in the information packet, I think the court system said they would be able to handle these cases without additional expenditures in the court system. They have room to handle these cases.
Through the chair to Representative Prox, I would submit a zero fiscal note on this bill. And the reason for that is that although I don't I would say that the average number of cases that would be coming to the court is more in the order of 30 to 35. I recognize the prior testimony that there were four or five or something in the last several years. But since the commission's inception in 2005, I mean, some at the beginning there were 45 cases. There would be a good number of cases coming from the court, in my view, although it's hard to predict precisely. But if we got 30 more cases, it is still something that I would not put a fiscal note on because we have 45 different judges. And if they got one of these cases each per year, that is not something that we would need new personnel for or new clerical staff for. So even though it would be more work for the court system, it would not necessarily cost the court system money. And that's why in the past I have submitted a zero fiscal note on bills, on this bill, which has been around for a number of sessions.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody else wants to, otherwise I have another one.
Go ahead, Representative Prox.
So I think you said that likely that a given court would only get one of these cases a year, did you say?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, if I said that, I might have misspoken. We have 45 Superior Court judges. If we say 30 to 35 cases would come, it would be, by statistics, less than one per judge. However, I mean, in reality, most of these will come to the Anchorage judges, perhaps Juneau and Fairbanks, but certainly the population centers are where most of these cases arise.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
Go ahead.
And then would the court tend to submit these cases to the same judge as the judge has time to hear cases?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, no. These cases are among the most difficult a superior judge would have to handle. These were moved from the court to the commission in 2005 because they're very time consuming. The courts were fairly slow at getting the decisions out. They're unlike other things that Superior Court judges do. Superior Court judges do take administrative appeals from different agencies in some circumstances. Many, many these days go to the Office of Administrative Hearings within the Department of Administration. But it's true that the Superior Court does take some appeals. These appeals are unique, and it's an arcane and complex area of law. There are always lots of medical records. There are expert witnesses. Now, and they're submitted merely on paper. It isn't a trial because it's an appeal from the board's decision. So these are not highly desired cases by the court. We always distribute cases that come in the door randomly. It's a computer. And so we would not have, for example, one judge take all of them.
Paula?
Go ahead.
Would there essentially be training costs, additional training costs, as opposed to a judge hears three or four of these cases a year, as opposed to three or four judges each hear one? Would there be effectively a training cost for the court system to, for the judge to come up to speed on, yes, a very arcane?
Through the chair to Representative Prox, there would be a cost in terms of time, but I don't anticipate that we could send a judge to a training school for workers' comp. It wouldn't be a fiscal cost to the court. It would be a judge spending time on this appeal instead of something else. But every case that comes in is something a judge has to handle. But we would not anticipate providing any specific training to any one judge, particularly because we would then need to send all the judges to that training for the occasional case that arises. And we provide training on cases that are, I would say, more common or something that people want the training on because they see it in their courtroom more often.
Mm-hmm. And is that sort of, I hate to be too flippant about this, but is that sort of normal practice for a judge to, if you will, learn on the fly? That's not what they do, but that's kind of what you do.
through the chair to Representative Prox. It, in some ways, I suppose you could put it that way. For example, a judge might get a big oil and gas tax case only once in their judicial career, and they might not have practiced in oil and gas law previously. And then that case is something the judge really has to focus on learning about from the party's briefs and questions and research. Mm-hmm. So if that's what you're saying, that would be something the judge would be doing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I can't think of anything else right now.
Well, I have a question for the bill sponsor, Representative Rauscher. So the $433,000 that you say this would save, so I assume that is the budget then for this.
Yes.
Do you know what amount of that is how do I say this, spread across departments? So often office rent will be shared in different, you know, components in the budget, and it might not necessarily be that even if you zero it out here, we're still, the state's still paying essentially that same amount. So do you know how much of that's actual dedicated personnel or expense?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Rep. George Rauscher. This amount would come directly out because this is what the cost is to pay for the two commissioners. This isn't a cost of facility or anything like this. This would be the direct pay for the two full-time employees, and then the money it takes for them to travel and whatnot around the state. So that cost would be taken out. So that where we are looking at a reduction of $433,000.
Okay. Representative Prox?
Yes, if I just want to make sure I didn't.
There we go.
Through the chair, do you know whether these commissioners are effectively administrative law judges, or is it somebody pulled with expertise, I would hope, from the off the street?
So through the chair, Representative Prox. So actually, two of them have no legal background at all. They have one lawyer and two that don't have any. They function essentially as an appellate court, but they, two of them do not have a legal background.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Rauscher. Next up, we have House Bill 57 from Stanley Wright. Please approach the table and begin your presentation.
To the chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I am Representative Stanley Wright, House District 22, and I'd like to thank you for hearing House Bill 57. The legislation, House Bill 57, also known as an act relating to review organizations and permitting an emergency medical services provider to establish a review organization and relating to patient records. Currently, emergency medical service providers, often referred to as EMS, are not included in the definition of existing law that prescribes the privacy protection afforded to fixed locations, medical facilities, i.e. hospitals or clinics, when forming and operating review groups. The purpose of the bill is to bridge a gap so that we can allow our first responders to operate more efficiently and effectively. The legislation offered today is very similar legislation which has been adopted in other states that face a similar shortcoming in defining languages. Thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 57 today, and I will now defer to my legislative aide, Mr. Pai Ryden Randall, to explain the bill in further detail.
Through the chair, and for the record, my name is Pai Ryden Randall, legislative aide to Representative Stanley Wright of House District 22. I'd like to thank the chair and the members of the committee today for hearing House Bill 57 today. In regards to the House bill, it will address several sections of AS 1823-070, which, as written, offers privacy protections only for these fixed medical establishments and the employees thereof when establishing or operating as a review group. Excluding the EMS agencies from privacy protections for review organizations as described in the statute has opened the door to excess litigation and the abilities from those in the EMS field from being able to communicate feedback and recommendations that could facilitate a higher success rate when responding to emergency situations. With the passage of House Bill 57, and thereby giving the same guidelines that we give to other members of the medical community, we can expect the EMS groups and workforce to develop and operate at higher levels. And we would expect a zero fiscal note on this, as that there's no money that needs to be dedicated to changing this. If anything, there might be minute positive from the reduction in tying up court systems. But at this time, I would like to call upon our invited professional testifiers, Brian Webb and State of Alaska EMS Medical Director, Dr. Mike Levy.
Mr. Webb, if you're on, you can go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairman Sumner and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Brian Webb. I'm from Anchorage, and I represent myself today as a 45-year Alaska EMS provider, and thank you for the opportunity to speak. And House Bill 57 seeks to correct EMS's omission in the original medical quality assurance statute, as mentioned. Alaska EMS is only asking that the legislature amend the statute to correct this inequity. Your EMS services should be afforded the same quality assurance program protections that our fixed healthcare facilities in Alaska have enjoyed for so many years. We're not asking for anything unusual, as a number of other states have already enacted this very legislation offering these QA protections to their EMS system. And Alaska's fragile EMS system continues to largely function via volunteerism. While many view this staffing method as just our ETTs, EMTs, and paramedics, surprisingly, many of our rural and super rural EMS services also have volunteer medical directors who, out of a sense of selfless service, they step up so their community can have a state-certified EMS service. These physicians are vital. For an EMS service to exist, it must have an Alaska-licensed medical director. There's two major points of our system's frustration, and that is these physicians, they have all the quality assurance protections while working in their clinics or critical access hospitals within their communities. Yet, when they don their EMS medical director's hat in that very same community, they no longer have those protections. Secondly, and of equal importance and concern, is that the EMS services themselves receive no protections in the current statute either. This should be alarming to us all. And when our volunteer EMS medical directors learn of this inequity in their professional activities, they will often resign from EMS service. This issue seriously impacts safety and health of our Alaska communities, as well as the very existence of our rural EMS services. So Alaska is just asking for the legislature to help us provide the fix that the other states have already done for their EMS systems. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee, thank you for your consideration of our proposed legislation. And that completes my testimony, and I'll remain on the line should there be any questions or comments. Thank you again.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Webb? Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm guessing that in the normal medical world, the practitioners have a professional liability coverage, insurance coverage. Do you know whether that is correct or not?
Through the chair, Representative Prox, that is correct. However, much of their coverage that they have, their common coverage, doesn't carry over as an EMS medical director, and Dr. Levy could probably speak better to that to that subject when he's able to speak.
Okay. to whomever, I guess, through the chair. Is professional liability coverage available to the in the EMS field?
Representative Prox, perhaps we should let Dr. Levy testify. He may have some more.
He has not yet. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he hasn't yet.
I'm sorry. I'll wait. Yeah. Sure.
So, Dr. Levy, if you're on the line, can you please state your name and begin your presentation? Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Sumner, members of the Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is Dr. Michael Levy. I'm the immediate past president of the National Association of EMS Physicians by the State of Alaska, EMS Medical Director. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for Anchorage Area Wide EMS, the EMS Medical Director for agencies including the Anchorage Fire Department, Chugach Volunteer Fire and Rescue Department, Kenai Peninsula Borough EMS, and have the honor to sponsor other EMS agents. I am a physician. I practiced in Alaska since 1989. I'm board certified in emergency medicine, internal medicine, and subspecialty board certified in the specialty of EMS medicine. EMS medicine is a subspecialty that offered board certification by the American Board of Medical Specialties in 2013. This is an acknowledgement by the House of Medicine that EMS is a distinct practice of medicine, that EMS is clearly a part of the healthcare system. EMS is evolving as a versatile and mobile community health resource, integral to regional systems of care that prevent and treat acute illness and injury, as well as chronic ailments. EMS systems must be people-centered systems, which involves processes, protocols, and practices designed to provide the best outcome for individuals in their communities. EMS practitioners at all levels should deliver care guided by best practices and evidence as established by best science and confirmed through a rigorous and routine review of the quality of care relative to those standards. While the value of encouraging peer review and quality assurance has long been accepted as a way to improve the care delivered to patients, the protection from discovery in the state of Alaska has not explicitly included EMS quality improvement. During the last few difficult years, a polarized society has been able to agree on at least one fact: EMS providers acted heroically. We need to honor their ongoing passion and sacrifices to help their fellow citizens by making it easier for them to receive feedback on the care provided. I'm confident if you speak to these women and men, they will confirm that one of the greatest stresses is that internal voice that asks, "Did I do the right thing?" They give all they have to help the injured, the ill, make medical decisions all along the way, yet may not get a thorough review of how they helped, or maybe even how they could have helped more. House Bill 57 is an important step to support our EMS heroes. I ask you to please support this important bill. Alaska EMS is just asking you to fix this broken process. Other states have already done. Mr. Chairman and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee, that completes my testimony. I remain on the line to help with questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Levy. Questions?
Well, that was helpful. But through the chair, I'll ask the same question. Is there professional liability coverage available for the service that is being provided?
Again, through the chair, I'd be happy to answer that question. And you're talking about for EMS clinicians, EMT paramedics, or are you talking about EMS physicians or people acting as medical directors or both?
Through the chair, I think I'm talking about the advisors, not the providers or the technicians. I think that's what this bill is focused on, correct?
Well, I can answer that question, but I'd like to answer the second question as well, because I think it's really important differentiation. Regarding medical insurance or malpractice insurance, typically, malpractice insurance and administrative coverage for the practice of EMS medicine is available on the market. There's limited numbers of agencies that provide it, but it is available at a cost, a pretty significant cost.
Okay.
Does that answer your question? Because I'd like to answer the second part of your question, too.
Yes, that answers that part of the question. Yes, thank you.
Right. Yeah, so the liability aspect is certainly important, but the important thing about having coverage for peer review isn't whether or not you have malpractice coverage for it as much as it is the chilling effect of the possibility of discovery of these proceedings that need to be quite frank and have great candor. So if people feel that any of this is, can be discovered when we're just trying to improve quality, then people won't volunteer information that's critical to improving the process. And this has been recognized for years and years, so that's why we already have the existing bill in place to cover other covered entities such as medical clinics and hospitals.
Okay, thank you. I'll have to think about that. Thank you.
Okay, if I have time, I'd be happy to explain further if I've not made myself clear. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Levy. And then any other questions for the bill sponsor? Representative Wright. Oh. Okay, thank you, Representative Wright. Next up, we have House Bill from 29, from Representative McCabe. Members of the committee had questions for Director of Insurance Lori Winghire. We do have her present here today. So we wanted to give Director Winghire a chance to address those questions. Please come up to the table, and if members still have questions, some were actually addressed, and you should have a handout and should be also on BASIS addressing some specific questions previously that were raised. But if there are more questions, now is the time to ask. Representative Fields.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and through the chair, thanks, Ms. Winghire, for being here as always. And I was just curious, I think we heard about umbrella policies. I haven't had one of these policies. How many umbrella policies are out there, like the ones discussed at the last meeting, if we know? Thank you.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Lori Winghire. I'm the director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. I don't know the exact number. I could go back and pull our annual report and see if I can figure it out or give you a rough indication. I do know that there are not a lot. People don't tend to buy the excess liability. They buy the primary auto. They buy the primary homeowners, but they don't buy the excess.
Could I ask a follow-up?
Go ahead.
Okay, well, thanks for getting back to us with that. And I think at the last hearing, there was some discussion around how basically forcing insurance companies to cover people who they perceive as higher risk, whether they are higher risk or not, could increase prices. Is that something you think we should be concerned about? Is it possible that insurance companies might just stop offering a type of coverage? I'm just thinking if there's a small group of people getting this and now we're making insurers cover a group they don't want to cover, price increases, cancellation of coverage, or there are other kind of unintended consequences we should worry about. Thank you.
Through the chair, Rep. Fields, that's always a concern. We are a very small market. We're less than 1 million people. So when you look at insurance products, we are not the big draw for a lot of insurance companies. That's why we have so few up here. So there's always a risk that an insurance company, if we mandate anything, it doesn't matter if it's health care or property and casualty, that they'll just say it's not a big enough market to continue to play in and either withdraw the form or the policy or not write in the state of Alaska.
I think one more question, Mr. Chairman, if I might. Through the chair, how would we gauge the degree of that risk, if there is a way to judge the degree of that risk, that they would stop offering umbrella policies or that there would be a significant increase in cost or something like that? Thank you.
Through the chair again, Representative Fields. I don't know that I know how to do that, to be honest. I'm not real sure how we could gauge what insurance companies, how they would react if HB 29, for instance, passes. I do know that Representative McCabe has a point here. I talked to the independent agents, and they did tell me that when you're an elected official in the state of Alaska, and I'm assuming elsewhere, you're not able to get an excess liability policy. I had a young woman who's been a producer for years down in Petersburg talk about being on a school board, and she's an insurance producer and couldn't get one. I could not find anything for political affiliation, but he is right in his argument of being an elected public official. I just don't know if we're going to see a mass exodus of insurers not wanting to write this, or if they're going to say it's not that big a deal and, you know, charge a little bit more and continue to write it or provide it for public officials as well as others.
Thank you.
So I guess I'll ask Ms. Winghire. So HB 29 is not specific to umbrella or excess liability insurance policies. Are there any other insurance lines that you think that this might have an impact on? I know that, the discussion has centered around those, but could there be some other sort of insurance that, I guess, representatives or elected state officials have an excess risk experience for?
Mr. Chairman, that was one of the questions that we late, but we did submit a letter to the committee this afternoon. It was a question from Representative Prox last week. And I did talk to my Consumer Services Division. We went through our database. We could not find where we've ever had a complaint for a public official, regardless if it's a state or local school board, borough, assembly, where someone has been denied a primary homeowner's, auto liability, watercraft. It seems to be on the excess liability where the problem exists.
Okay.
If I might, the other question that was asked, and we did provide an answer, and it was from Representative Ruffridge, and he asked about the amount of coverage, if any, does the Department of Administration Risks Management Division cover for members of the executive branch, and we did provide an answer that they self-insure and what is provided for not just the executive branch but also the legislature, and that is in your letter.
Thank you, Mrs. Winghire. Yes, we do have the letter. I'd see on here that the question from Representative Prox was specifically about homeowners insurance policies, and you'd said that those were not denied, but you're saying that broadly across other lines you've not seen that.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We could not find where anyone has made a complaint with the division that because of their elected status, they were unable to obtain insurance on the primary lines.
Thank you.
So our homeowners are auto.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, that concludes our, Representative Prox.
I don't know, I guess maybe we should ask that of the bill's sponsor or just find the answer to that, to the question of whether insurance companies will just vote with their feet, essentially, and leave the market if we force that coverage. There's actually, I wish I had been thinking about this about an hour ago. I was talking to a fellow in the building that would have had the answer.
Well, Representative McCabe is present. If you would like to approach and answer Representative Prox's question, bill sponsor.
Thanks. Through the chair, Representative Kevin McCabe, the representative from District 8 and the sponsor of HB 29. Yeah, that's one thing we considered. We thought about that, and we are a small market. We thought, you know, maybe the insurance companies would just shut down all umbrella policies in Alaska, and if that's the case, we certainly wouldn't want to do this. But we couldn't find anybody that would answer that question on whether or not they would do that. I suspect that it will end up, if you are an elected official and you want an umbrella policy, they will offer it just at a higher rate, similar to if you have three tickets or if you have a DUI, you can still get insurance. It's just at a higher rate. And I suspect that's where they'll come down, but nobody really wants to answer that question. So the short answer is, I don't know.
Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair to Representative McCabe. You mentioned at the other hearing, you've heard from some people who have faced this. Have you faced this circumstance of being denied coverage? And if you have, did the company or companies articulate why they were denying you coverage?
Yes, I have. And two other people that I talked to, one of them is paying a higher rate for their policy. But yes, I have. And the specific answer was, we can no longer offer you umbrella policy because you're now elected official.
Okay, but follow up through the chair. But they didn't articulate why that presented a problem for them.
Say that again?
They did, through the chair, they didn't. The insurance company did not articulate why they thought your status as an elected official presented higher risk or would motivate them not to offer you that product.
Through the chair, no. They simply said you're now an elected official, so we can't offer you an umbrella policy anymore.
Thank you.
So actually, I do have a question, perhaps for the bill sponsor or Mrs. Wingheyer. If insurance companies discontinued offering that line of insurance in the state of Alaska, because it's tied to a person and you can move across state lines, what prohibits you as an Alaskan resident from purchasing an insurance policy in California or anywhere really for an excess liability line?
So through the chair, I think I'll let Mrs. Wingheyer answer this. The particular insurance company that I was dealing with really has no agents in Alaska. It's an out-of-state insurance company. So.
Sure, but yeah, what would stop me as an individual from calling up an agent in California and saying I want an excess liability policy or anywhere?
Mr. Chairman, to your question, the first thing you're going to do is fill out an application. The broker that you call to get that application needs to have a license here in Alaska to sell to you. And when you put down your address as an Alaska resident, even though you're dealing with a broker out of California, the insurance company is going to tag you as an Alaskan, and Alaskan rules are going to have to apply.
So that's by address or residency? Do they have to verify residency, or how does that work? What if I had a P.O. box in California or somewhere?
Mr. Chairman, they very much will ask you for a physical address on an excess liability policy.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Wright.
Through the chair. Thank you, Chair. Are there consequences for someone using the P.O. box and then, you know, they have an incident and now they need to use the insurance? Are there any consequences?
Through the chair, Representative Wright, there are no consequences for having a P.O. box. But on a homeowner's policy or on an auto even, they're going to want a physical address of where that auto is located or where the property is located. But there are no consequences of having a P.O. box.
Go
ahead.
Through the chair. So when I say consequences, I mean like the insurance not pay out if I used the P.O. box and they found out when I had an accident that, okay, I had an accident, but I live in Alaska. I'm not from California.
Through the chair, there's a possibility that would be fraud, and then they would not pay out. It just depends what the product is and what the question is, and depending on your answer in it. But having a P.O. box itself is not going to deny you coverage or change a claim.
Representative Prox.
I have actually some personal experience in this. I used to sell insurance. And insurance companies are very concerned about fraud, and they will drop you like a hot rock if they decide somehow you defrauded them. And they will refuse to pay a claim if they think there was some fraud. So that isn't an option. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Representative Prox. I was not encouraging anybody to commit fraud, but we do have a lot of Alaskan residents that snowbird, and their particular residents at any point in the year may be up for question. And so maybe they still are an Alaskan resident. Maybe they have a residence in Arizona,
right?
And maybe they put that down on their insurance application. Right. And I mean, I think this is a legitimate question.
Yep.
So,
Mr. Chairman, you could have a home in Arizona and live up here. And as long as you put that address as Arizona of the physical residence, but your mailing address is Wasilla, they're going to write that Arizona policy for Arizona, but send you the bill in Wasilla. I mean, there is no prohibition. As long as you put down the correct location of the property, it can differ from the mailing address, but they will underwrite it to the physical location. I hope that helps.
Representative Prox.
Right, and this is just speculation, but I would expect that this is kind of a nationwide policy because liability applies wherever you are. If you bought the policy in Arizona, for the sake of discussion, and something happened in Alaska, the liability coverage transfers across the state. So I would, we need to get an answer from the insurance companies. And I'm quite concerned that the answer in the Alaska market would be that they would just walk away from it.
Representative Prox, and that might be, but so my question is, because it's not tied to necessarily a physical structure like, you know, property-based insurance. Go ahead, Representative Prox.
Yes. The reason is that the umbrella policy, the excess liability policy, assumes underlying insurance coverage through homeowners or auto or something that provides up to, I don't know, what typically $250,000 in coverage off the homeowners or auto policy, and then the umbrella policy takes over after $250,000 is how this comes into play and how they kind of interface. I hate to speak. It would be better to have somebody who represents the insurance industry or some company give us an official answer rather than my not as official answer.
Maybe we can get some invited testimony on that in the future. All right. Well, that concludes our business today. So seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:07 p.m.